From VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Volcanoes have played a dominant role in helping shape Earth since the world was thought to have formed some 4.5 billion years ago. Violent volcanic eruptions in the Central American country of Guatemala and Hawaii's Big Island have been grabbing news headlines in recent weeks. The recent eruptions of Guatemala's Fuego volcano have, so far, taken over 100 lives and left thousands more homeless. Hawaii's Kilauea volcano also continues to wreak devastation and threaten lives since a series of violent eruptions began back in early May. According to the Smithsonian Global Volcanism Program, so far this year, there have been 50 confirmed eruptions from 49 different volcanoes throughout the world. Media reports in recent years have also spotlighted the possibility of potentially apocalyptic eruptions of what are called supervolcanoes. A recent study led by researchers at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign provides some comfort, suggesting that geological signs indicating a potentially catastrophic volcanic eruption would be clear far in advance. So, today on this Science Edition of Press Conference USA, we'll talk about one of the most destructive forces of nature, volcanoes. My guest for today's program is Dr. Charles Mandeville, Ph.D. He's the program coordinator of the Volcano Hazards Program at the U.S. Geological Survey. Dr. Mandeville, where are the most active volcanoes on Earth?
Typically, the most active volcanoes on Earth, Rick, are going to be around the Pacific Ring of Fire. There's about 1,550 volcanoes above sea level worldwide, and 955 of those are along the Pacific Rim, either in the Andes and Central America, the northwestern portion of the United States, over to Alaska and the Aleutian Islands, and then over to the Kamchatkan Peninsula in Russia, and then the Kuril Islands, and then the Japanese island chain, and then on into the Philippines, and then on into the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, and then Tonga Kermadec down near New Zealand. We've got, at least just in the Pacific Rim, we've got over half of the world's active volcanoes. The others are going to be in the regions of Italy and Greece, obviously, and also the Afar region of Africa and the East African Rift, and then in the Indian Ocean, and then in Indonesia, which has over on the order of about 120 volcanoes.
So if you were to guesstimate how many active volcanoes exist right now, what would be your guess, or what would be the number that you know?
1,550. Those are just the volcanoes above water. So along the world's mid-ocean ridge systems, you literally have thousands of volcanoes in the deep ocean basins at about 2,500 meter water depth.
I'm curious about the Pacific Ring of Fire. Why is that region more prone to having active volcanoes than any other places on Earth?
Well, pretty much all along the Pacific plate margin, you have the Earth recycling some of its tectonic plates back into the Earth's deep mantle. And when that happens, you're sending one plate down into the Earth's deep mantle. It's a plate that has altered volcanic rocks in it that have water-bearing minerals that might contain up to 13% weight of water in them. When these water-bearing minerals descend back down into the Earth's mantle, they're actually dehydrating and decomposing, and they're fluxing the Earth's mantle, a mantle wedge that just lies just above where that plate is going into the mantle, with water. And water's got a very, very interesting property. When you add water to rocks, you lower the melting temperature. Mm-hmm. So it facilitates the melting of the Earth's mantle, and when you melt the mantle, you produce basaltic magmas similar to what's erupting in Hawaii right now. That basaltic magma is hotter, and it's less dense than the surrounding rocks, so it wants to rise, and it rises and it stages at various levels in the crust. Where it comes to the surface, we have a volcano.
I'm curious as to what causes this magma to be produced, first of all, and to make it so darn hot.
So as you go down into the Earth's mantle, and actually even through the Earth's crust, in volcanic regions, you're dealing with a gradient that's about 40 degrees centigrade per kilometer. So that's a lot more like about 70 degrees Fahrenheit per kilometer. So by the time you get down to the 110-kilometer depth, or relatively 70-mile depth below the Earth's surface, it's hot enough to melt rocks. And as I said before, when you add a little bit of water to that mixture from the that's being liberated from the downgoing plate, it facilitates melting. And once we have melt focused underneath the crust, it finds a way to the surface because it's buoyant.
From what you're mentioning, there is a correlation between tectonics and volcanism?
Very much so. So most of the world's volcanoes that, you know, are capable of erupting explosively are what we refer to as subduction zone volcanoes. And these are places where we're recycling the Earth's tectonic plates back into the mantle. There's another series of volcanoes, though, that don't have anything to do with recycling of tectonic plates. They're fed by either hot spots in the Earth's deep mantle, such as Hawaii or Iceland or Reunion Island in the Indian Ocean. And Yellowstone is also a hot spot.
Well, we definitely want to talk about Yellowstone in a few minutes. Can you run down the structure of a volcano? When we're looking at a volcano, normally we see a mountain and smoke coming out of the top of it. What makes a volcano a volcano?
A volcano is any place on the Earth where you have a vent that is emitting magma to the surface, either as lava or as ash. And typically, volcanoes come in two shapes. They come in the very conical, somewhat symmetrical shape that we're used to if we look at, say, Mount Rainier or Mount Hood in Washington State or Mount Fuji in Japan. And those are alternating sequences of fragmental volcanic rocks that you get from explosive eruptions, and also lava flows that armor those fragmental rocks and help the volcano be somewhat resistant to erosion. So it's like building sandcastles at the beach. You have explosive eruptions that put eruption plumes of ash and boulders up into the atmosphere. That material comes down, forms fragmental deposits that are concentrically located around the vent that they were erupted from. And those fragmental deposits typically can lie at about 25 to 30 degrees, similar to building a sandcastle at the beach with dry sand. And then occasionally the volcano will go into an alternate mode of eruption and produce lava flows. And the lava flows cover these fragmental rocks and essentially armor the volcano and make it more resistant to erosion. So what we refer to as stratovolcanoes are typically alternating layers of lava flows and fragmental deposits from explosive eruptions that have built a cone. Now, in the case of the Big Island of Hawaii, we have what's known as a shield volcano. And shield volcanoes tend to be very, very broad, very, very low-profile mountains, but they're enormous. In other words, if you think of the Big Island of Hawaii coming up from the ocean floor at 6 kilometers down and then extending for another 4.4 kilometers above sea level, it's the biggest mountain on Earth.
What finally causes a volcano to blast, finally erupt? I've seen occasions where a volcano is seen smoking and magma is like stirring up inside its crater. What finally triggers it to erupt?
The main thing is, to have any kind of eruption, we have to have a system that is pressurized at depth. And it's usually gas-saturated magma that is more buoyant than its surroundings, that's temporarily held in place in some type of subterranean storage area or magma chamber. But eventually the pressure will build to a point where the container breaks. And when the container breaks, the magma will find its way to the surface, either as a lava-forming eruption. If, for instance, the magma that's erupted allows gases to pass through it rather easily, although as you increase the silica content of a magma, it becomes more viscous and it's much less passive to gas moving through it, in other words, and the only way to get the gas out of the magma is actually for it to explode.
You mentioned magma, you mentioned silica there, so my next question is, what is the composition of volcanic material? I know you have magma, and you also have ash, rocks, things like that. What are the composition of these materials?
Okay, so typically a volcano that's erupting in Hawaii will erupt basaltic lava. And that's a lava with about, say, 50% SiO2, maybe 12% iron oxide, maybe 3 or 4% titanium oxide, maybe 12 to 14% aluminum, maybe 6% magnesium oxide, and maybe on the order of 2% sodium and potassium combined. And then the other thing that these magmas have within them is dissolved gaseous compounds like sulfur, chlorine, CO2, and water.
When we're talking about the gas coming out of the volcano, how dangerous is this volcanic gas?
It can be, for instance, in the case of Hawaii, we have sulfur dioxide being emitted. You also have CO2 that is being emitted, and literally at the fissure vents, the gases are coming out at roughly 2100 degrees Fahrenheit. So not only are they poisonous, they're at extremely high temperature. So being exposed to them is not a good idea.
Since we've made the connection between volcanic eruption and tectonic activity, in other words, do volcanic eruptions cause earthquakes or vice versa, earthquakes causing volcanic eruptions?
There's been only a few cases where you can cite a large magnitude earthquake as having possibly driven a volcano into eruption. And by this, I mean like the 1960 eruption of Cotopaxi volcano. It literally had a magnitude 8 earthquake almost directly below its summit. However, one of the things that has to happen for a volcanic eruption to occur is whenever you break rocks in the subsurface to move magma, you're generating a lot of small earthquakes as the magma moves to the surface. And if you have sensitive seismometers distributed, say, within a 15-mile radius of the volcano summit, you'll record all those small magnitude earthquakes. They're usually smaller than magnitude 2. But they tell us something is happening at the subsurface beneath that volcano, and as such, an increase in the number of small magnitude earthquakes beneath a volcano is often a herald that a volcanic eruption, you know, might be coming in the future.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. Today we're talking about one of the most destructive forces of nature, volcanoes. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website at voanews.com/PCUSA, or you can download it from iTunes. We hope you'll get in touch with us either through Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or by sending us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. Now, back to our guest, Dr. Charles Mandeville, Ph.D. He's the program coordinator of the Volcano Hazards Program at the U.S. Geological Survey. Charles, are eruptions predictable?
Fortunately, we've gotten much better at predicting eruptions for the simple reason we've gotten much better at instrumenting volcanoes, not just with seismometers, but other instruments like continuous GPS receivers, tilt meters that can tell a change in slope on the volcano with an amount that's maybe 1/1000th of a degree. Mm-hmm. And we also have a whole new generation of satellites up in the sky that can tell us when the ground at a particular volcano is swelling. And it's literally inflating because the magma chamber system beneath the volcano is being pressurized with gas and a supply of new magma. What's really transformed volcano monitoring in the past 20 years, and certainly within the past 10, is the fact that we can have multiple real-time data streams coming in on a volcano from ground-based instruments as well as satellite-based instruments, such that we can see eruption precursors. Those eruption precursors consist of changes in gas emission, changes in groundwater chemistry, if we've been sampling the groundwaters at the volcano on a regular basis, increases in the number of small magnitude earthquakes beneath the summit or nearby, changes in slope on the volcano that we can detect with both continuous GPS instruments and tilt meters, and looking at satellite imagery for hot pixels. In other words, gases are often some of the first things released as the magma is transiting in the crust, and the gases, because they've been in contact with the magma, are pretty much at the same temperature, and they will find cracks and zones of weakness to the surface because they're the most buoyant and mobile component that the magma is bringing towards the surface of the Earth. So if we look at satellites that give us infrared images, and we look at infrared data from satellites at night when there's a low background, we can tell subtle thermal anomalies associated with where new hot gases are coming to the surface. We're also fortunate in that many of the volcanoes, particularly the picturesque ones in Alaska and the Pacific Northwest and in the Andes, have summit glaciers. When these gases are escaping to the surface, they'll form new cracks in summit glaciers that have opened. And typically when you see the cracks forming in the summit glacier, followed by emission of volcanic gases that we can measure either from helicopters or fixed-wing aircraft, or a whole new generation of multi-gas sensors, we can get a real-time change and a measurement of what the volcano is doing. So there are a number of precursors that typically happen at a volcano before it erupts, and fortunately, we know where the volcanoes are.
I'm curious about the eruption process itself. Are there specific steps or stages associated with a volcanic eruption?
Sometimes you'll see a migration of the small magnitude earthquakes towards the surface, but you've got to have a dense seismic network to kind of see that happen before your eyes. But we've done it successfully, for instance, at Mount St. Helens. We've seen it at Mount Etna in Italy. And it really depends how much of a lead time you get. Depends on how good your in-ground monitoring instruments are. But typically, you'll see changes in gas emission, you'll see increases in seismicity, and it's also that if you've got digital broadband seismometers, very high sensitive seismometers as part of your network, there's also information carried in the frequency content of these small earthquakes that tells us magma is on the move.
Does a volcano have a set supply of magma, or is it constantly being refreshed and augmented?
It's probably more episodic than anything. So we, in looking at the past eruptive histories of volcanoes that we have worldwide, we definitely know it's not a constant supply of magma that's being supplied unless it's a hotspot volcano like Hawaii. Typically, what we have is periods of augmented growth in that volcano's history where you might have several eruptions over a course of, say, a few ten thousands of years, and then it goes quiet for another 10,000 years, but then it gets reactivated. Some of our oldest volcanic centers are on the order of, you know, a million years old. Others have only been active volcanic centers for a few hundred thousand years.
If that's the case, then I know that magma is stored in huge chambers beneath the volcano itself. So what happens once all the magma is gone, the volcano is done erupting? What happens to the volcano then, and especially with these now empty chambers underneath?
Well, typically, when you have chambers that exceed, you know, say 1,000 cubic kilometers, and these kind of classes of volcanoes have been referred to as super volcanoes, where you're literally, within a matter of weeks to months, emptying a chamber that's 1,000 cubic kilometers. And what happens is the crust above this huge chamber system actually subsides. And so they're actually kind of sinister, because when you're looking on the landscape for a volcano, there's none that are obvious. In fact, what you've formed is a caldera. And typically, for instance, the Yellowstone caldera in the Four Corners region of the U.S., it actually forms a caldera that rivals the state of Rhode Island in terms of area.
So in other words, if you have a caldera that is a humongous size, that means that there was a volcano there that once blasted an awful lot of magma.
Yes. And another good example is Long Valley Caldera in California, in the eastern portion of the Sierra Nevadas, just east of the Sierra Nevadas. Another example is what is now Crater Lake in Oregon. There you had eruption not too long ago, about 7,700 years ago, of 50 cubic kilometers of magma, not a super eruption, but still a very large eruption, typically putting ash out to, 50 kilometers up into the stratosphere, and certainly would have had global climate impact because of the amount of sulfur dioxide gas that was put up into the stratosphere during that event.
There's an important question I need to ask you, and that is, what is the Volcanic Explosivity Index, or VEI?
It's kind of a catch-all way to rank volcanoes and volcanic eruptions in terms of the impacts that they would have and also their relative size. But it's also a matter of what kind of fragments were produced during the eruption. In other words, what is the proportion of ash that it produced versus ballistic fragments that typically settle half a kilometer from the vent. And it's an overall measure of how big an eruption was and how intense it was. Kind of a dual classification, if you will.
And I understand it's 0 through 8?
0 through 8. So right. Something like Krakatoa 1883 is a 6. Tambora, is a 6 or maybe a 7. Things like Yellowstone and Long Valley, when they erupted, were 8.
Wow.
They're at the end of the scale.
And we've been hearing a lot about Kilauea, a volcano in Hawaii, has been in the news. What exactly has been going on there with this volcano?
Okay, so Kilauea has been an eruption, and Kilauea is the youngest volcano that comprises the Big Island of Hawaii. There are actually 5 different shield volcanoes that comprise the Big Island of Hawaii. Kilauea is the youngest, and it forms the southeastern portion of the island. It's been erupting since 1983 for over 35 years now. What's changed is the fact that we've had a change in the eruptive points from which Kilauea is erupting. Up until late April, Kilauea was erupting from its summit crater at Halemaumau, and it was also erupting from a smaller vent down the rift, lower in elevation towards the northeast, called Pu'o'o. And what's changed is we've had catastrophic draining of the lava lake at Pu'o'o, as well as a drop in the lava lake at Halemaumau in Kilauea's summit, and movement of magma from those two vents downrift in the subsurface to where it's emerged and created new fissure vents down in the Leilani subdivision and the Lani Puna garden district of the lower Puna zone. And we've got now as many as 22 fissures that have been active, many of them sourcing lava flows that have now reached the ocean. The other thing that we're seeing is Kilauea's summit has produced ash plumes that have ranged anywhere from 3,000 feet to as high as 30,000 feet on May 16th at 4:15 a.m. in the morning, Hawaii Standard Time. And that's caused us at the USGS Hawaii Volcano Observatory to put out a volcano observatory notice for aviation, because whenever you have a volcanic vent emitting ash up to 20 and 30,000 feet where commercial airlines fly, we have to get word out to the aviation sector as well as the general populace and all the emergency responders and land managers in the vicinity.
Is it because the ash that's flying up from the volcano is so fine that it gets into the equipment of the airplanes, their engines and so forth?
Yes, you can actually have volcanic ash, which is largely volcanic glass particles, typically less than about 2 millimeters in size, actually played out on the jet engine turbines and caused jet engine failure. And a similar incident happened, for instance, in 1989 during the eruption of Redoubt in Alaska, where a Dutch KLM flight 747 with 230 people aboard inadvertently flew into the ash plume from Redoubt volcano, and all four engines on that 747 failed, and then they had to descend relatively 16,000 feet in, you know, a matter of minutes just to restart the engines. Fortunately, they were able to restart the engines and land the plane safely at Anchorage, but the plane itself suffered about $80 million worth of damage. And you can imagine it's a pretty harrowing experience when you've got a 747 that's in glide for 16,000 feet and you've got 230 people aboard and other critical flight instruments like your altimeter and your airspeed indicator and your cockpit window are being sandblasted with volcanic ash.
I understand a new potentially dangerous issue has been raised regarding those who live near the volcano, something called VOG. What is VOG and how is it produced?
VOG is a term for what is often referred to as volcanic smog. And it's really the sulfur dioxide gas that's being degassed from the magma as it comes to the surface as lava is combining with moisture in the atmosphere to form fine sulfuric acid aerosol particles. So it's forming an acid vapor, and the vapor particles are typically submicron in size. So they're easily breathed into the lungs, and this is an irritant of the eyes. It's an irritant of the lung tissue, and it's a health hazard for those who might be downwind of any fissure vent that has opened. The other thing is that depending on the wind direction, it can be blown off island to the adjacent island of Oahu and Maui. So on days when the Kona winds are blowing, it can be blown, you know, to the north, to the other volcanic islands of Hawaii.
Charlie, we're running out of time, but I did want to step into the issue about supervolcanoes. We've been hearing an awful lot about supervolcanoes in the media. I know several science-oriented channels of TV have run specials about supervolcanoes, and we mentioned earlier about Yellowstone. What separates a supervolcano from just a regular volcano?
The fact that they've, in a single eruption, erupted on the order of 1,000 cubic kilometers of material. It's literally the size of the eruption that has ensued from, you know, an event that may have taken place over several weeks to a month.
So what's the biggest eruption so far?
Probably the one from Toba in Sumatra in Indonesia. That happened about 74,000 years ago, and it put out on the order of 3,000 cubic kilometers of material. As a matter of fact, there's a constriction in the human genome right around then, where probably there were less, you know, humans on the planet in the aftermath.
We were talking about Yellowstone being predicted to erupt. How likely is that to happen, and when is it expected to erupt?
Well, in other words, the chances of another supervolcano eruption from Yellowstone happening are probably about one in a few million, because its last one was 640,000 years ago. However, Yellowstone is still powered by the heat from magma, residual magma that's still at depth, and we have active hydrothermal vents and geysers. What is more probable at Yellowstone is that we have actually steam-driven explosions, and they've occurred, you know, as recently as the 1930s as well as the 1890s, where you can have around several of hydrothermal pools where you've got hot water coming to the surface, you can actually have an explosion that can throw out bread box and refrigerator sized fragments, you know, a few hundred meters from the vent. And in a park, you know, that has over a million visitors per year, that is a concern for us.
Dr. Charles Mandeville, thank you so much for taking time and basically telling us just about everything we wanted to know about volcanoes.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this science edition of Press Conference USA. My guest for today's program was Dr. Charles Mandeville, the program coordinator of the Volcano Hazards Program at the U.S. Geological Survey. The science edition of Press Conference USA was produced in the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington, D.C. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Thanks so much for listening today, and be sure to join us next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.